Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1980 Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, and mythological creatures that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the Cthulhu Mythos section of Deities and Demigods. In the last episode, which should come out the same day as this one, we talked about the Cthulhu mythos in general and about Cthulhu specifically. Today, we're going to move on through the alphabetized section, beginning with Azathoth, the hideous demon sultan, and following up with the Byakki, a bunch of birdie devil-y things. So let's get started. First up, we have Azathoth. Now, I mentioned earlier that normally what you get is a big beefy god at the top of the pyramid with 400 hit points. And here, that has been chosen to be Cthulhu. But in fact, Azathoth also has 400 hit points. And so do the other major deities of Cthulhu mythos. I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Like, I recall in the Norse mythos section, for example, Odin has 400 hit points, but Thor has 399. So there was clearly some kind of attempt to establish a hierarchy, which isn't the case here. I like it. I like the fact that there isn't a kind of hierarchy of power. They're all, each of them, as buff as the next one. Anyway, Azathoth is, I mean, arguably buffer still than that. He's a very dangerous opponent, although I don't know the circumstances under which you would fight him, since it is a bubbling mass of nuclear chaos that exists at the center of the universe. A blind idiot god. The perfect creator deity for Lovecraft's heartless cosmology, right? Azathoth is basically sort of like the divine watchmaker, but without any of the like care or craftsmanship that implies. Azathoth, we get the impression, created the universe, or whatever, and then hasn't done much since. There's actually a reference in the dreams in the witch house to the idea that the Necronomicon conceals this thing under the name Azathoth. So the suggestion there is that the like religious identification of Azathoth is merely a veil that humans put over the primal force at the center of the universe in order to personify it just a little bit. I think it's crucial to the Cthulhu mythos that Azathoth is an unreasoning god. There's a wonderful, I think it's a comic adaptation of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by Jason Thompson, and in it, Azathoth appears as this sort of protoplasmic figure with like mouths and limbs and whatever growing out from it, and then all surrounding it are these like streamers or ribbons or scrolls. It's been a long time since I read it, and they all just say on them in different languages, "I want." And this is an interesting characterization of Azathoth as something that has will, but no mind. Normally, when we think of the creator god of the universe, we would think of a figure of creation, of generation. But here we have Azathoth as a figure of consumption, and I think that's almost better. In particular, because generation is going to be a different deity shtick, and you don't want to overlap too much. Azathoth is described as a demon sultan, and that is frequently used. So Lovecraft does seem to kind of exotify Azathoth, although, again, it never appears, it's just referred to. I think Lovecraft found the idea that the universe was this chaotic place very, very unsettling, and Azathoth is the ultimate representation of that chaos, just a reaction that goes on at the center of the universe, worshipped by things that don't understand it and it could never possibly understand. But that point about worship is actually discussed here in the Azathoth section, where it says that the clerics of Azathoth are all insane. They try to encourage others to become insane, and is doubtful that Azathoth even knows they exist. Which I think is interesting. And actually, I realized that I didn't talk about clerics or Lord Help Us Paladins of Cthulhu in the last episode. So let's think for a little bit about the cults of the Old Ones and the clerics thereof. I would be remiss, by the way, in not talking about the old school D&D-inspired RPG, Astonishing Sorcerers and Swordsmen of Hyperborea. It might be Swordsmen and Sorcerers. I can never remember. But which posits a Howard-esque sword and sorcery fantasy setting in which the deities include a bunch of these Cthulhu mythos creatures, including a lot that come from Clark Ashton Smith. So I played, the one time I played it, a cleric of Atlaknaka, who is a Clark Ashton Smith creation. Anyway, clerics of Azathoth and clerics of Cthulhu. First off, I want to talk about this term insane. The literary trope of insanity is an important one in like 19th and early 20th century horror. It's important to Lovecraft. It's important to a lot of gothic fiction. I think it fits a little uneasily to the modern gamer, the modern reader, because I think we're much more conscious of the science and the social context of mental health, and, you know, we are aware that individuals with mental illnesses or, you know, suffering from mental stress are not like the, you know, the characters who go mad when they're confronted with horror. That trope is so important to the genre that in a way we want to maintain it, but without suggesting that this is an appropriate characterization of people who are actually mentally ill. So I think we have to draw a pretty bright line between insanity, the literary trope, and mental illness, the real world phenomenon. And I'm not sure that we have yet developed an effective way of doing that. I think it's something that we really do need to think about. So I think that the easiest way then to think about these mad mythos clerics is that they're not, in a sense, they're not insane at all. They're enlightened. Sanity, quote-unquote sanity, what the world calls sanity in a mythos setting, is a measure of how effectively you can lie to yourself. How effectively you can lie to yourself about the nature of reality. The more you know about how the world really works, the less, quote-unquote, sane you are. So I don't know that the clerics of Azathoth are insane, or certainly that they would see themselves as that. As far as they're concerned, they understand the world. They see a world that makes no sense whatsoever. And what they really want to do is make sure that everyone else understands it as well, right? Either because, you know, the truth is the truth is the truth, or because misery loves company. Now, how would you do that? I think that is the goal of the Cleric of Azathoth, right? To do things that demonstrate the ultimate meaninglessness of the universe and mankind's helplessness in the face of the chaotic power represented by Azathoth. And I think that's a little bit different from the Cult of Cthulhu. So we talked about the Cult of Cthulhu and its idea of human license, right? The Cult of Cthulhu is all about breaking down the barriers that limit human action. If you want to kill, kill. If you want to steal, steal. If you want to terrorize and dominate, you terrorize and dominate. And you just also have to accept that the same is true of everybody else. And you're never going to experience the pure joy of the old ones while you're living in the shackles created by the human mind. You know, shackles of law and morality and community. What's interesting is that the cult leaders of Cthulhu don't seem to be the kind of impulsive, violent, hedonistic characters that this would imply. So perhaps what you get in the Cult of Cthulhu is you wind up as a cleric of Cthulhu, as one of these cult leaders, if what you would do if your id were unfettered is, you know, control and dominate and manipulate, and you wind up as a cultist of Cthulhu if what you would do if your id were unfettered is eat all the fish or kick your neighbor in the face. And I suspect that the Cult of Cthulhu would only accept, like, your bad inner drives as the real ones, right? I don't think that the Cult of Cthulhu could accept the idea that people have a natural goodness to them. So if you say, yeah, if I were given my druthers, what I would do is nurture and protect and respect and, you know, all those other lawful good things, I think the Cult of Cthulhu don't believe you. Not don't believe in it like they don't espouse that idea, but don't believe in it like they don't think it's real. And I think whether their idea of human nature is right or wrong is very much up to the campaign. But I think that they are trying to make their view of human nature right. Like, the cultists of the Great Old Ones think that they are revealing the true nature of humanity and the true nature of the universe. From an outsider's perspective, what they're doing is trying to create that nature, trying to reshape the naturally occurring universe into something that is more consistent with their beliefs. I mean, that's fanaticism as a motivation in general, right? But so I think the cultists of Azathoth are maybe more kind of mystical and esoteric, all about trying to help people reach the state of spiritual enlightenment where they understand that nothing is real and nothing matters. And if those people then, you know, go off to summon monsters or, you know, create rifts in space-time that devastate whole kingdoms or just, like, sit down and contemplate the eternal verities, I mean, you know, whatever, the point is that more people understand. So I think among the Cult of Azathoth, you probably have these kind of like guru or demagogue type characters whose task is to reveal the folly and madness of reality to their worshippers. It strikes me that the description of Nyarlathotep from H.P. Lovecraft's Nyarlathotep is very much that, right? And he's sort of, if that guy were a bard rather than a cleric. Whereas the cultists of Cthulhu might have agendas that are sanctified by the gods' teachings. So Cthulhu says, you know, shout and kill and revel in joy. And like, well, what I want to do is drown this city. What I want to do is break this crown. And Cthulhu says that I am like the old ones if I'm indulging my most evil impulses. And when mankind have become like the old ones, then the old ones will return. So I'm not just doing this to gratify my own delight in the suffering of others. Oh no, this has a higher spiritual calling. Now, obviously, most parties aren't going to accept either of these maniacs as player characters, but you can certainly see the case where the Cleric of Azathoth's spiritual enlightenment, so-called, might grant him access to more of the secrets of the universe. He might actually be someone who knows a great deal, kind of magically speaking, but it'd be tricky to get out of him because what he wants is so at odds with what most people want, right? He doesn't want money or power or fame. He has spiritual goals. So basically like dealing with a holy person, but just one with a very skewed sense of holiness. And by contrast, a Cleric of Cthulhu might be quite worldly. So if you needed a Cleric of Cthulhu to cast some heal spells or whatever, you would have a hard time persuading her because chances are she'd want something really terrible, but it would be something comprehensibly terrible. As a side note about clerics, still not sure what a Paladin of Azathoth looks like. The Defender of Chaos? Obviously, that is a modern interpretation of paladins. In old school D&D, you're not going to get Paladins of Azathoth. So anyway, Azathoth is more of a cosmic constant than a god that you interact with, right? It's essentially just a symbol of what the universe is like. Meaningless and kind of awful. That's Azathoth. If we're looking for something that the player characters might actually run into, we've got the Byakki. Now, Byakki as a category are kind of, I don't want to say invented, but subsequent texts like Call of Cthulhu sort of have taken the Byakki as they appeared in the writings of August Derleth. I think their first appearance is in the house on Kerwin Street. You're going to have to forgive me when we get to Derlethy stuff because I'm not as familiar with Derleth's work as I am with Lovecraft's, which is a position that I recommend to you. But so they appear in some August Derleth stories, and they are basically kind of flying utility monsters. They come from outer space, they come down to Earth, and they can pick up people and carry them wherever, so they can serve as steeds. And there's a good bit which suggests that their like metabolism is heightened when they arrive because they just flew in from space and bore their arms tired. So the first thing they want to do is feed, which I guess is your science fiction explanation for the act of a sacrifice. Though no, it's not a sacrifice. We're just giving it food because it needs the energy. Byakki are often associated with the mysterious flying creatures that appear in H.P. Lovecraft's story The Festival, but those creatures are never called Byakki. It was August Derleth who came up with the term. And Byakki are associated with the deity Hastur as kind of his servants. And so Byakki basically work in Dungeons & Dragons as a minion monster summonable by clerics of Hastur. So you might get a powerful cleric of Hastur riding around on a Byakki or being carried around by a Byakki or summoning up a swarm of Byakkis to attack people who threaten them. Now, Byakki are intelligent, but they have certain rules, and one of those is that they will obey, in D&D, that they will obey people who carry the Elder Sign. So you might wind up getting from place to place by means of a Byakki, because Byakki can fly. So in the fiction, Byakki can fly, like, between worlds. In D&D, what that means is that they can fly pretty much anywhere within the Prime Material Plane. They can teleport. They're entities from another plane, and I assume that they get from place to place basically by flying out of the Prime Material Plane and back into it at a different point. So you can see a D&D party in a pinch hijacking a Byakki to use as a steed from one part of the Prime Material Plane to the other. But the Deities and Demigods Cthulhu Mythos section kind of suffers the most when it deals with creatures like the Byakki, or when we get to the Fire Vampires, or even the Deep Ones, because ultimately, these are just D&D monsters, right? Like an interdimensional flying creature that can be controlled if you have the appropriate magic item is very much within the bounds of a conventional Dungeons & Dragons monster. So the Byakki are no real problem. The only thing that you would have to do is make sure that the right to summon them is particularly horrible. They also provide much-needed muscle. I mean, they're pretty beefy with 10 hit dice, although a pretty minimal AC of 9. But they're handy in a scrap, so you definitely get the idea that, like, a Cleric of Hastur is probably not all that tough personally, but in a pinch can summon up a horde of Byakki. Well, not a horde, it's, I think, D4 Byakki. Either to, you know, if it's 4 of them, then 3 of them are going to fight off the assailants while one of them helps them escape. If it's one of them, then it's just, hi, yo, Byakki, let's get out of here, unless you get the Elder Sign and command it, right? I don't know what you do when two people who have equal right to command a Byakki are trying to get it to do something. I would assume it's the one who summoned it, but I don't know. And I do think that Byakki are one of those aspects of the Cthulhu mythos that suffers a little bit when you put it into a Dungeons & Dragons setting, because what's weird about it, like, it's a big flying monster. But in D&D, that's not that uncommon, right? A Byakki's not any more remarkable than a griffin or a pegasus or a doom bat or whatever it might be. But they do seem to have done a thing where each deity, or a lot of the major deities anyway, in this section get their own kind of servitor monster. And that's nice because you I mean, you're going to fight cultists, obviously, but you also kind of want to fight the, like, signature monster of the deity that you're fighting. You don't want to go straight into the deity because you probably don't have any chance to beat it. So it's nice to add a little bit of flavor. And it can work as a clue, right? If your characters have learned a certain amount about the Cthulhu mythos, then this fact that they're dealing with a deep one, they might be like, uh-oh, you know, we know there's a Cthulhu going on here. Or and when they run into a Byakki, they're like, ah, so the cult of Hastur is behind this. I understand now. So they're a monster that's also a clue, which is kind of neat. I gotta say that the illustration of the Byakki here is not quite how I think of a Byakki. It's very conventionally devil-looking, which I think aesthetically is probably a decision you don't want to make when you do Cthulhu mythos stuff. Even the most devilish-looking mythos monster, the Night Gaunt, has this feature of being faceless that gives it a particular eerie quality that I feel like is not present in the Byakki illustration here. So we've got our first Servitor monster race, and they're basically a good utility minion monster. I say minion, again, they're quite tough, but they're not a plot all by themselves. And then we have Azathoth, who's almost more, you know, who's much more the kind of god that you would have as a setting detail, because he has no agenda. Basically, he's like reverse Shang-Di, right? Shang-Di just exists to justify and enforce the cosmic order, or even just represent the cosmic order. An order that is ultimately hierarchical, but mutually benevolent. Azathoth exists to embody a cosmic disorder, to embody a cosmos that is uncaring, random, and ultimately destructive or doomed. I think it would be pretty good to have a setting where the default religion was the worship of Azathoth. Because I think that, to digress slightly into what I think about people, I think that in general, if you look at religious belief throughout history, people have tended to ignore or adapt the parts of their religious teachings that were inconvenient for them. Whether that's wanting to get rich while adhering to a religion that says that you should be poor, whether that's wanting to be violent, adhering to a religion that says you should be peaceful, or indeed, whether it's wanting to be peaceful while adhering to a religion that says you want to be violent, ultimately, people wind up kind of just rubbing along. So you can definitely imagine a kingdom where the official faith is the worship of Azathoth, and, you know, every year on Azathoth Day, all the people go and, like, make some minor sacrifice to Azathoth, and, you know, when something goes wrong in their life, they go, oh, well, the universe is chaotic, Azathoth rules all, but the priesthood of Azathoth are just furious about these Christmas and Easter Azathothians and how they, you know, they only come to the temples when they want something, and they're like, that's really bad theology, that's not how Azathoth works. So you might have quite a lot of sort of ordinary Azathoth worshippers whose culture would therefore just have this little extra sheen of kind of hopelessness because they don't have a supernatural sense that the world is going to get better or that there's anyone on their side. In fact, they know that the cosmos is horrible. You know, who would rebel against that? I think it might be people like the Cult of Cthulhu, right? Like, the Cult of Cthulhu are driven. They have an agenda. Their agenda is to bring back the old ones, and they're not gonna just sort of go, oh, all will be as Azathoth wills it, and Azathoth basically wills stuff at random, so who knows? There's a supplement for the Cthulhu Live role-playing game in which there's a schism within the Cult of Cthulhu between sort of Orthodox Cthulhuites who believe that it's blasphemy to suggest that Cthulhu needs mortal help to rise from the dead, because he's all-powerful, and therefore he can wake up whenever he feels it, and our job is just to maintain things, you know, in preparation for his coming, and radical Cthulhuites who want to hasten the god's return. You can almost see that being like a schism between the cults of Azathoth and Cthulhu in Dungeons & Dragons, because your Azathothites just think, well, you know, the universe is random, everything is chaos, nothing means anything, all will be as it will be. And the Cthulhuites think, look, when the stars come right, the time for action is now. We need to strike. You know, we need to improve humanity so that it has the necessary qualities to bring back the great old ones, quote-unquote, improve. So player characters who want to thwart the Cult of Cthulhu might find themselves allying with the Cult of Azathoth, even though the Cult of Azathoth are every bit as evil, but they're evil in a kind of fatalistic way, which might make them willing to kind of defend a do-nothing position against more radical Cthulhuist extremists. And again, I think you could definitely have, I've mentioned clerics of Azathoth, but I feel like Azathoth also sort of works for wizards. Like, you can imagine, and not that a wizard necessarily would worship Azathoth, but that a wizard would be like, yeah, Azathoth kind of sits in the center of the universe, radiating power. There's no meaning or direction to this power, so what we're going to do is just adapt and divert it. Azathoth is a big engine, but it's up to somebody else to apply the steering. Alright, so those are our Cthulhu Mythos gods for this episode. Next time, we're going to talk about Cthuga, we're going to talk about Cthuga's flame creatures, and we're going to talk about the Deep Ones, the famous fishmen of Lovecraftian fiction. Next time, on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.